Love's a little like electricity, isn't it? Well, in a moment, we're going to talk about the electric universe. David Talbot and Wallace Thornhill back on Coast to Coast with me, and we will talk about some incredible things that are going on in space in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We're going to introduce two great guests for you. First of all, David Talbot. David is a comparative mythologist. He's devoted a number of years to examining the origins of ancient beliefs, symbolic traditions as well. He's the author of The Saturn Myth and co-author with Wallace Thornhill of The Thunderbolts of the Gods. We talked about that a couple years ago. His construction of the ancient sky was the subject of a featured documentary called Remembering the End of the World. Let's say hi to David Talbot. David, welcome back.
Yes, sir, George. Good to be back. Thank you.
Me too. Looking forward to this. And, of course, Wallace Thornhill is an Australian physicist. His long investigation of the electric universe offers a revolutionary view of the solar system's history, the nature of the sun. He's the co-author, as I just mentioned, with David on Thunderbolts of the Gods and the Electric Universe. And that book will be coming out June 1st, I believe. Wallace, good to have you back with us.
Thanks very much, George.
And here we go. So Wallace said, tell us, first of all, when we say the electric universe, what are we talking about?
Well, it seems to have been in a remarkable oversight that, we use electricity for almost everything in our daily lives, and yet we ignore it when it comes to the workings of the universe. And we know that nature never does things the hard way. So if we find electricity to be so extremely useful, you would imagine that nature has done the same. So the work that I've been doing is looking at all of the observations over decades and centuries and David Talbot's reconstruction of what happened in the dimly remembered past. And I've found that you can explain all of it simply by introducing electrical energy.
And David, how far back do we go here when we talk about the electric universe?
Now, are you asking me how far back we go to the point at which Wall and I converged with respect to our life's work and so on? I mean, that was like 15 years ago.
Well, let's go back even further, though, with this electric universe. I got to believe when the universe started, and there's a big debate about that, this electric universe was always the way it was, wasn't it?
Well, the way it was and what human beings thought they were seeing would be two different things. Now, my own life's work, this is like over 40-plus years of investigating the origins of ancient traditions and so on, that work convinced me that things were seen in the ancient sky that aren't seen today. So the sky has changed. Unraveling what that could possibly mean was the purpose of my work for many years. It culminated initially in the publication of a book called The Saturn Myth, published by Doubleday, when Doubleday was the biggest publisher in the world. And that began a process of people coming into an interest in planetary history and planetary catastrophe. Sometime later, I converged with Wall Thornhill, and it became clear that my reconstruction of things seen in the ancient sky in a much different planetary system converged very well with Wall Thornhill's electric universe investigations. So that gave us a convergence or a partnership, a combination of understanding the human experiences of the past and then seeing these experiences in terms of the electric universe paradigm today. So it's a very, very nice, convenient partnership that we've developed covering an interdisciplinary subject, planetary catastrophe in the past. It's the way it shows up in the on the planetary surfaces today, and the way it was experienced by human beings in the past and translated into world mythology.
And David, when you talk about planetary catastrophes, what are you talking about here?
Well, planets moving on different courses than we observe the bodies today. We see a very orderly solar system today. It was only a few thousand years ago. Let's just pull 5,000 years out of the hat, because the chronologies are not clear once you get back beyond a few hundred years. But there was a period of planetary upheaval that helped to project human imagination into civilized consciousness. In other words, what was on the minds of the builders of the first civilizations were planetary catastrophes. The roles of the planets close to the Earth, lightning bolts flying between planets.
Huge, too.
Upheaval on Earth up to a global scale. Planets so close to the Earth that they appeared in the sky as towering forms. And these planets are named. We can identify the role of Mars as this towering warrior figure form. We can identify Venus as this prototype of the mother goddess, mm-hmm. the lovely figure in the sky, transformed into the raging goddess, wreaking havoc on the world. The planet Saturn as the primeval sun god. These powers are named in the birthplace of astronomy in ancient Mesopotamia. And nothing about the ancient images of these planets fits anything that we observe today in planetary behavior. So that's the heart of the mystery. Is it possible to actually reconstruct what was seen by taking more seriously the ancient languages, their pictures, the images carved on stone, their sacred texts describing overwhelming catastrophe, the roles of particular named planets in these events? All of this can contribute to a reformulation of our picture of the ancient cultures if we will give that serious attention to the literal meanings of words and symbols.
And Wallace, has the universe always been as violent as it was in the start? Did it start violent, and it is now?
Well, we really don't know. This is the thing. We make up stories about the past that suit, in particular, the mathematicians who like to be able to retro-calculate. But you have to realize that nobody was there to witness the events that David was talking about. Those that were tried desperately to let succeeding generations know about it through the monumental works they did. But the story of the formation of the solar system as we see it today had nothing to do with the formation of the universe. Nobody knows how that started,
right,
despite what Big Bang theorists tell us.
Well, we'll talk about that too, Wallace, because that still confuses me.
Yeah. So the situation we see today, you can't just retro-calculate into the past and say, you know, 100,000 years ago the planets were here and this is what you would see in the sky. That's pure supposition and speculation. The evidence that has been amassed by the mytho-historians like David and Dwight Cardona and F. Cochrane and some others just shows that nothing fits if you do that. In fact, when you go to the earliest civilizations like the Australian Aborigines, their recollections of what happened just fit so well. And the things that they talked about in their so-called dream time can all be understood in terms of the information we've got from the other ancient civilizations.
It's pretty remarkable.
Global, and it all fits together and makes a coherent story. The problem for scientists is to get their heads around the fact that we really don't understand some things that they think they know right now.
Which leads us to the question about the Big Bang and, of course, yes, the taking spirituality out of it, because I think that is an easy reason to make excuses of what happened.
Yes, that's true. In fact, it really is a reconstruction of the biblical story, complete with a miracle at the beginning. And the point is that astronomers ignore evidence which goes against the Big Bang. There's no research allowed on an alternative. Even the Institute for Electrical and Electronic Engineers, which is one of the biggest professional organizations
yes.
in the world, recognizes plasma cosmology, which is at odds with the Big Bang, but you won't see that taught in any university.
not being a physicist or a scientist, but I just don't get my handle on a Big Bang. I can't comprehend something exploding, banging, to jumpstart everything. And then
that's not surprising. I mean, it's like throwing a ball into the air and then having it accelerate away from you upwards. You know, it just doesn't fit anything that we know or experience. But the problem, I think, boils down to the way we teach kids these days. You're not given alternatives to look at. But there were alternatives 100 years ago, but, and a lot of the arguments against what we now believe were very good, and they should be presented to students and let them think about it. But instead of that, they're given all of these facts, so-called, and equations, and they have to go away and memorize them, and those that remember them best get rewarded and the others don't. That's not the way to teach kids. You have to challenge them with ideas and let them think for themselves.
I mean, is it possible, Wallace, that the universe was always here? And that
that's
just
as far as we can tell. The work of Dr. Halton Arp, who is a well-known professional astronomer, in fact, his name pops up all the time in relation to the names of galaxies and so on, he showed definitively that the assumption that actually is the very basis of the Big Bang, that is that redshift, that is the stretching of light from the blue end to the red end of the spectrum, is all due to the recession, you know, something moving away like a train whistle dropping in pitch as it races past you. He showed that even Hubble himself didn't believe that the expanding universe was the right answer. He felt there was something we were missing. Halton Arp proved that Hubble was right. And that means that based on Halton Arp's work, that the universe is not expanding. It appears relatively static. But that introduced the problem, because if that's the case, why isn't everything falling in together? Because gravity is supposed to suck everything in.
Right.
And so Halton Arp himself felt that we really did not understand gravity. And it's only in recent years that I've been able to piece together the fact that gravity is short-range attractive and long-range repulsive. But because we're based on the Earth, we've always thought that what we experience on Earth is universal. We have a bad habit of transferring our experience on Earth and saying it's universal when there's no evidence for that.
See, when I think of gravity, I think of something pulling on something else. And
that's true. If you're up close, it's like two magnets. You know, you can hold them so that they're opposing poles are facing one another, and you can feel that tug towards one another. But just imagine if you turn one magnet around so that the same poles are facing each other, and then you will feel the repulsion. Well, gravity is the same kind of force in the electrical model. So that if you're up close to an object, all of the atoms in your body are attracted towards the body that you happen to be living on, the Earth.
So when you look at...
But if you move away beyond the sphere of influence of the Earth, then you're under the influence of the Sun. But what happens if you get out into space beyond Pluto, beyond the Sun's influence, then you are under the influence of all the matter in the rest of the universe,
that's
including
right.
the galaxy. And that, as Halton Arp has shown, is actually repulsive. Things don't collide. They tend to avoid one another. And this comes back to this idea of the solar system being quite different in the past. People would say, well, you know, didn't objects collide with one another? No, they didn't. They would come close and they would repel one another and also exchange thunderbolts of the gods, as they were called, in the process. And that also helped to establish order. So this is one of the fundamental aspects of the electric universe that fits with David Talbot's work.
And one more question, Wallace, about this. With the, you know, billions of galaxies in the universe, why aren't they just falling? I mean, they're just all there in place.
That's right, and this is where Halton Arp himself said that there must be some aspect of gravity which is repulsive. In other words, objects do not fall towards one another. They tend to avoid one another. And that makes a whole lot of sense, because then you have a universe that's in balance.
That's right.
The Big Bang Theory is totally out of balance, because you need an explosion in the beginning to separate everything, and then at some point in the future, everything is going to either fall back in again, and you have a big crunch, as they call it, or it's going to expand forever, and everything will fizzle out into the blackness, which is a pretty dismal sort of a prospect.
Well, David, let's bring you in as the mythologist here and get your thoughts on why everything seems to be balanced.
Well, actually, you know what, George, I don't know if I've ever considered the question quite in that way, but what we do know is that the early stargazers and sky worshippers perceived the sky in completely different ways than we perceive it today. Now, we see planets, we see bodies, planets and moons moving on highly regular courses. Why is that picture of planetary stability and regularity so contrary to the experiences in an earlier time, a few thousand years ago, where nothing was feared more universally than the motions of planets? Nothing was observed more carefully than the motions of planets out of the fear of a return of doomsday. Well, this whole connection of planetary behavior to doomsday anxiety is completely nonsensical in our time. But if you can put yourself into the vantage point of those who experienced planetary catastrophe, you begin to see that their descriptions of the cosmic players, a great comet Venus, a primeval sun god Saturn, a great warrior figure Mars, these ideas about the planets are very specific and they're essentially global.
You think Velikovsky was right?
Well, I had a special interest in Velikovsky, which actually, George, got me into my life's work. It goes back many years, but I published a 10-issue series on Velikovsky that remains today. It published from 1972 to 1974. It today remains the most definitive coverage of the science and the history of Velikovsky's contribution. And yes, the planet Venus was, a few thousand years ago, a spectacular comet. It was feared around the world. The story of the comet Venus can be reconstructed in great detail just using the points of agreement between the different cultures. The comet Venus is a gateway for us into an ancient world that has no similarity to our world, our sky, today. So we consider the study of the comet Venus and the study of other planets in their ancient identities to give us a radically new perspective on the ancient world, that the stargazers of ancient times had real perils to deal with. And in their defensive measures collectively, their magical practices and so on, nothing was more important to them than anticipating catastrophe.
Wallace, what do you think? Venus, a captured comet?
Yes. The thing about comets is that they're generally regarded as leftovers from the formation of the solar system. But
right.
That too is one of these once upon a time, long, long ago fairy stories which suit mathematicians because, of course, they can retrocalculate back to the beginning, or so they think.
All right, well, both of you stay with us. We're going to take this quick break, then we're going to come back and talk more about the electric universe. And we'll get into just what it means to have an electric universe, because even the body, our bodies, are electric as well. Now, don't forget, you can also like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. We send out little remarks all the time. Major, major announcement coming up for Coast Insiders tomorrow, and for those of you who've been thinking about becoming a Coast Insider, wait till you hear what we have to say. And also, those of you who want to email me anytime, any day, it's george@coasttocoastam.com. Don't touch your dial. We'll be right back with David Talbot and Wallace Thornhill as we talk about the electric universe. Okay, welcome back. David Talbot with us, Wallace Thornhill as well. David, your thoughts on the electric universe. And the book comes out in about a month, right?
No, I don't. The book I think that you're referring to was the electric universe. And that's actually been out for some time, George. What we have in just over a month is a conference. And it may be that we got our dates and
got it mixed
titles
up.
Confused here. But
yep.
We have a conference coming up in Phoenix. It's in the Electric Universe Conference, our fifth annual conference. We get a very inspired group coming into these events. And, of course, Wal Thornhill will be a featured speaker at that event. I'll be speaking, and we've got a dozen other premier speakers who will be appearing at our conference in Phoenix on the 17th to
Super.
19th of June.
And that's on your website?
Yeah, and I would urge people to check out thunderbolts.info. That's thunderbolts.info. That's the Thunderbolts Project website, and everything that you would want to know about the conference, about DVDs and special videos, and we're very active on the internet these days with video productions and other internet presentations of the electric universe, with lots of updated material coming out of the space age, coming out of new investigations and extended investigations of the human past and the role of catastrophe
mm-hmm.
in shaping human imagination at the birth of the early cultures.
Now, let me ask you this, David, and I'll ask you too, Wallace. The fact that this is an electric universe, David, in your opinion, what does that mean? What does that mean to us?
Well, I think it means maybe more than we would naturally imagine, because we do not normally think in terms of the electrical underpinnings of the natural world. And Wal Thornhill is, of course, the person to talk about the way this shows up in things that we observe going on in space and in the electricity of life and so on. But if I am asked myself about the meaning of the electric universe, what continually comes to mind for me is the idea of connectivity. And this is a very meaningful human concept, because a world that has no connectivity is fundamentally meaningless, and a human being cannot tolerate meaninglessness. So a connected world offers us a sense of connection that gives meaning and a sense of purpose, a sense of something worth investigating, connections between human beings that may not show up at the level of divided, of let's say, of human division and war and all of the things that pit one human being against another. But as our investigations actually look more deeply at the electricity of life, and we see that there is a quality to every human life. There is a nature of human consciousness and human awareness that every human being has in common with every other human being. There is a principle of connectivity then that is very close to the heart of the electric universe movement, because this movement has come increasingly to accent the nature of connectivity. That's connectivity across the cosmos, connectivity between planets and planetary relationships to the sun, and of course the connectivity that comes out of the electricity of life, and just emphasizes to us that there is something that unites all human beings. It is essential to human identity, and it is connectivity.
Okay, and your thoughts on that, Wallace? The electric universe. Tell me the significance of that.
Well, I think David hit on the essential fact of the electric universe, and that is that it involves the electrical connection between all matter in the universe. And that connection is far faster than the speed of light. On our scale, it's instantaneous. Now, quantum experiments in physics have shown this. They call it entanglement, or spooky action at a distance. And the reason that it's given these sort of wishy-washy names is that nobody understands it yet. because nobody can consider the idea that the force of the electrical force between all charged matter operates instantly. But when you think about it, this instantaneous connection is required both in the gravitational force between the sun and the earth and the planets. If that weren't so, the whole system would fly apart because the sun wouldn't know where the earth was at any instant, and the earth wouldn't know where the sun was, and the effect is like a slingshot.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to living systems, you could not control all of the trillions of chemical reactions and activity inside a living creature every second if you had to wait for signals to travel along nerves or even at the speed of light. It would still be too slow to coordinate everything so that you have a functioning, conscious, living creature.
Wallace, Nikola Tesla got it. He understood that the universe was electrical because everything he was trying to invent was going to tap into that.
That's right. He also rubbished the Big Bang.
Yes. Now I know why we liked him.
That's right. Yes, there have been a number of pioneers over several centuries. Faraday was another one who intuited that electricity was the fundamental force and was extremely important, and that when we understood it, we would understand gravity and much more besides.
Could we literally be able to pull electricity out of the universe, out of the atmosphere, and have free electricity, as Tesla probably wanted to do?
It's a little difficult because given the huge volume of the universe, I mean, we can't imagine it, the empty space out there. When I say empty, it's not actually empty, but to collect that electricity, you require something the size of a planet or a star. But there are other possibilities, you see. Once you understand this instantaneous interaction of matter, you begin to understand particle physics and nuclear fusion, all of these things, and you begin to understand that maybe it's possible much more easily than we thought. And, of course, there's been a lot of people working over the years on cold fusion and what's now called warm fusion, and it's my firm belief now that that is the way of the future, that we will find out how to harness nuclear energy,
yes,
in a harmless fashion and without all the drama that's required.
And clean, and too, right?
Expense.
A very clean energy, isn't it?
Yes.
I look forward to the day that we do that. I think we're close to that. I'm not sure they want to talk about it, but I think we're close to it, don't you?
I hope so, and I think there are some scientists who are giving it a serious thought.
All right, David, so as you look at the universe today, is it still changing?
Well, George, the universe is no doubt changing in ways that we don't even imagine today, and yet there is this underlying stability that we experience in our own cosmic neighborhood that poses an enigma for us, because our early ancestors were obsessed with catastrophe, and all we see is predictable motions of planets and moons, so predictable that it appears that with a computer we could retrocalculate the positions of the planets thousands of years ago. And in fact, scientists do that, and they express great confidence that those positions of the planets that they project back to 2000 BC, 3000 BC, are spot on, that this solar system is that regular and that stable. Well, how then could we ever explain that the planet Venus appeared in the sky as a terrifying comet, and that this comet image was recorded around the world, in fact, in every ancient culture? The hieroglyphs, the symbols, the language of the comet was attached to the planet Venus. That's a mystery that is just off the map in modern times. Yet we've examined that story of the comet Venus meticulously, and we see that it is a highly integrated, integral story, and it is so fully unified, the details have to be taken seriously. And that story of the comet Venus, this lovely planet becoming a terrifying power in the sky. This is the beautiful goddess, the goddess of love and light, that is transformed into the angry goddess, the hag or witch, the terrible goddess. This is a global theme. Nobody disputes that this is a worldwide image of the mother goddess. But where did that imagery come from? Was it just completely unrelated to anything actually experienced? Or can we go into that imagery of the mother goddess as the planet Venus becoming the terrible goddess, mm-hmm, and actually see a story so coherent, so connected in its parts, and so unified that we have to take it seriously? So that's where we have gone with life's work, examining the history of ancient ideas about planets, including Venus as the great comet. Venus was the prototype of comets. It was the preeminent example, the great comet.
How did it get captured, David?
Well, that would be for Walt to talk
all
about,
right,
but I'm sure that it has to do with electricity, George.
Wallace, yeah. how did Venus, here's it zooming around, and I assume it came around every certain amount of years. How did it get captured?
Well, the very process of discharging material into space in the form of a comet tail is part of the capture process. In fact, it's a signature of capture, because that is an electrical discharge phenomenon. And when you alter the charge on a body, it acts to change its mass and its gravitational connection to the sun. And it does it in such a way that every time it encounters a planet like the Earth or Mars, and there's a discharge between the two planets will move apart and try and space their orbits so that they no longer interfere. So today we have Venus with what's actually been called by astronomers a cometary magnetosphere, in other words, an invisible comet's tail, which tickles the Earth when the two planets line up with the Sun. And the same goes for Mars. Mars gets tickled by the Earth's magnetosphere, and that's a tiny electric current that flows between the planets. But when the planets were in the process of being captured, those discharges were powerful and destructive, and also they tended to move the planets apart as fast as possible to prevent further interference. For that reason, we managed to survive these catastrophes.
Are things stable now in our solar system?
Yes, I think to have what happened then happen again, the Sun would have to capture another substantial planetary-sized body. And they're out there, they're floating around. The infrared telescopes in space picking up brown dwarf stars close to the solar system. When I say close, still quite some distance away. But that's the kind of thing that happened that started all of these catastrophes in the solar system, because the process of capture is one of all of the bodies having to readjust themselves to a new order. And that doesn't take long, as it turns out, because these electrical exchanges space everything apart and reestablishes order. There is absolutely no way a gravitational system can do that. In fact, the gravitational system is inherently unstable.
And David, let me ask you this then. In terms of life, why is it so unique to good old planet Earth?
Well, it does seem rather miraculous, and I don't know if anybody can actually answer the question from the vantage point of cosmic intelligence. How does it happen that it appears that things evolved so intelligently? And when I look back across a few thousand years to the kinds of things that occurred in ancient times, I just marvel at how we avoided total devastation. the planets.
We lucked out.
We either lucked out or there is something more fundamentally intelligent at work that we haven't come adequately to.
That's an interesting twist.
And I actually kind of go for that, that there is an inherent intelligence within the universe, no matter how crazy and disorganized it looked.
Can we
do that, but I don't publicly. I don't use the spiritual language in my public discourse because we are a broad interdisciplinary movement that does not assert any philosophical or religious persuasion. So this is very important to us because the interdisciplinary nature of the electric universe does not recommend a particular religious or philosophical view, and that's what we're studying. I have a private life, needless to say, and it takes me into other subjects. So I have an interest in what is a meaningful life, what is a meaningful picture of the world, but I don't, as a rule, make it a part of our public discourse.
But do you believe the fact that there is some kind of method behind it, intelligence behind it? Can you call it a god?
I can.
Yeah.
I don't ask other people to join us in any discourse about the spiritual realm or the nature of God, the nature of human identity, and these things. Every human being is always free to examine his own identity internally and to see what it is that connects him to other people, and just in standing back and observing the nature of life and the nature of our connection, we do move our experience and our sense of life toward an increasing sense of connection with other people. And that's the nature of the evolution of human culture, I would say. I mean, we came to realize the principle of equality, but how many thousands of years did it take before we actually recognized the violation of that principle in the subjugation of other peoples and in slavery and so on? What occurs is there is a recognition of the inviolate character of life and the essential universal identity of every human being. As that evolves over time, as it becomes more clear, crystal clear to a human being, he will not tolerate subjugation of other peoples. He will not tolerate slavery. He demands respect for every life. This is the nature of the evolution of human consciousness, I'd say. And within the electric universe community, this is a given, but we don't make that our message to the public as part of the electric universe community. We let people come in as atheists, they come in as ministers, they come in under every philosophical persuasion known to man, and they can feel comfortable that we're exploring the role of the electric force.
We're going to come back and take phone calls with both of you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.